Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Hey, Tim, nice to see you.
Mike, good to see you. It's been a while. You know, we all made it through the winter, but it's good to be back. And hopefully we're going to, you know, get back up to a regular routine here.
Yep. Thanks, Tim. And everyone, audience members, welcome to our 2024 season of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. We're joined by one of our European colleagues, partner Falk Schoing from our European offices. Falk, thanks for joining us. And could you tell our viewers a little bit about your practice and how it relates to security issues?
Sure. Hi, Mike. Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me today. Yeah, my practice focuses on European national security aspects in the sense that I work for clients in the space of government procurement procedures and also foreign investment control procedures, which obviously take national security at the heart of their cases. I'm based personally in Berlin, Germany, but I work out of our Brussels office because, as you might imagine, and as I'm sure we'll talk about today, there are quite a lot of EU aspects in that practice.
Well, thanks, Falk. I appreciate you joining us, particularly across different time zones. There's a lot of things we want to talk about today, but one of the perhaps most recent news developments that we wanted to start with was the announcement that the European Union has proposed a $1.5 billion plan to boost defense production. And they've also released I think it's the first ever defense industrial strategy for the EU. And coming from the DoD world, of course, my view is frankly always been somewhat NATO-centric, but this is a different avenue. Could you talk a little bit about your reactions to the defense strategy and also the plans for the use of funds that the EU has in mind here?
Yeah, sure. And I think I'll probably start by explaining why this is really a remarkable development. And you need to kind of go back and understand how the EU works, because the EU is an economic bloc in the first place, right? It brings together economies, forms joint policies, of course, but national security, foreign policy is something that still is very much within the competency of member states. So it is remarkable, as I said, that at EU level, the member states come together and say, okay, we see that there are so many challenges that we really need to work together better, and that we just can't cope with all of this ourselves. This has not been something, you know, without debate in the last few years, because the EU tried for many years to do something, or a bit more, you could say, in the defense world. But there was always some rejection, and this was very much viewed as a civil power. And for instance, even if there were proposals to have some R&D-related spending in the defense world, this was pushed back, and there was a clear focus on civil technologies. Now, with conflicts coming back to Europe, and not only there, but also in our vicinity, there is now more, I think, political readiness to address this. But it's only a start. And you mentioned the amount, $1.5 billion. That sounds a lot. But frankly, if you compare it, not only certainly with DoD spending, but also with what member states in Europe spend individually, it's still only a start.
And actually, to throw this into a little bit of context, so the U.S. defense budget now is, you know, up north, well north of $800 billion a year. My understanding is the European Union, you know, sort of union-wide defense spending is about $270 billion a year. And, you know, to sort of, you know, add in the Russia dimension, the Russians apparently now are spending about 6% of their GDP on defense. Kurt Campbell, who's the U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary, was at a think tank event yesterday, and he said that folks across the river are assessing that Russia has essentially reconstituted its military capability to pre-war levels in many respects, and that they are rapidly rebuilding their own industrial base. So I think that there is a, you know, an urgency, I think, to what the Europeans are doing. Do you think that, you know, the resources that are being put to this problem are, you know, enough even in the short run, or do you expect there's going to be, you know, a rapid expansion in the union-wide effort to increase defense spending and coordination? Thanks.
No, I think, Tim, this is a really interesting comparison with the numbers. And what it shows is the importance of the common EU actions here is probably less in the numbers, less in the budget. It's more in the political will of doing things together. And we shouldn't reduce the package just to, you know, spending 1.5 billion just because it's not as much as member states themselves actually put out there. But it's really more about understanding that in the long run, if we have all member states doing things themselves, we'll have 27 different programs for fighter jets, for tanks, for whatever you have. And it's more important that the cooperation in the sense of joint development, joint procurement, joint supply chains and supply chain resilience, that these things work out. And that's also part of the plan. So it's not only about the money, but it's also really about a common policy. And from that perspective, I think it is really ambitious. I am not overly optimistic that we would see an increase of the budget in the short to medium term. And that is just looking at how much money has been spent in the last few years on other issues. I mean, just think about the whole COVID crisis that we have just gone through. We have the economic transition in the sense to a more green economy that costs a lot of money because you have to change energy sources, modes of transport, etc. All of that requires a lot of investment. And then last but not least, you have the direct impact of these national security threats here and the war in Ukraine, which require many member states just to change things they're doing, whether that's trade with Russia, whether it's sourcing energy from Russia. All of that just costs a lot of money. And I think from that perspective, the number, I mean, it's more than symbolic. Of course, it is still a sizable number. But I think the importance is that you also engage private capital to flow into this. And that is certainly also a plan that the EU has, that there is more openness for investment in defense companies. That requires also some changes or clarifications to taxonomy of what is kind of acceptable investment for companies. I think we'll see more of that. It's a very complex program that's rolled out now. And of course, it's more complicated because we have seen years, if not decades, of underinvestment in Europe. And we now face a situation where the threats are pretty current. So everything needs to be done with some sense of urgency. And you and I know that when you're doing big projects and they're urgent at the same time, it's even more difficult than if you were just looking at the challenge itself.
Falk, I wonder if you could comment on some of the areas you mentioned, things that made me think of, like the interoperability that we have among NATO allies, right? That's a long desire, is that the technologies that are being used, you know, we don't want to duplicate, as you said, we don't want multiples of the same jet, multiples of the same firearm. There's a standard NATO ammunition. I remember all that from my Army procurement days. So in this context, what are your views on things that would be sort of good opportunities for a joint program, like combined European air defense or cybersecurity? There's just things I can think of that, you know, would cross borders. What are your views on some of maybe the areas that would, I think, have the most impact here as a joint development program?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one, Mike, because there are some projects like a joint fighter aircraft system, which Germany and France look into, or German and French industry have for years been working on kind of next generation of battle tanks. These are certainly lighthouse projects that you can put out there and that will be worked on. Interestingly, the most asked for type of supply in the current theater of conflict is ammunition and drones. Both pretty standard low-cost issues where you can certainly standardize, where you can certainly ramp up production quickly. And that's where we also see, in particular with the view on ammunition, there is a forum that the EU gave a short acronym called ASAP for a reason. So that is something that will bring European allies together. Otherwise, I think what is also relevant in this context, as I mentioned before, we have major challenges under a huge time pressure. And if you need to supply things quickly, you can't just have the luxury to develop for many, many years or decades something new. And these very complicated programs take a lot of time. So therefore, if you look at the statistics again, Europeans procure a large amount of their demand from outside the EU. I think it's currently, you know, north of 70% or so, and a lot, frankly, going to the US. And that's something that on the one hand is necessary to meet the current demand, but long term, the EU wants to be more independent, have more of this own production, because obviously it shows how times can be changing, how reliable supply chains can be. And therefore, we'll see a lot of effort put into the robustness and the production within Europe.
You know, I want to pick up on the word ammunition that you mentioned earlier and pivot a little bit to Ukraine, if you don't mind. You know, obviously, both the existing stockpiles of ammunition and the depletion of them and the ability to resupply the Ukrainians has become a larger issue as the months have worn on. And especially now that the U.S. is sort of in a holding pattern as far as funding. You know, how is Europe sort of shouldering the burden, you know, in the spring of 2024? It's a little bit of a test case. And if you could discuss the Taurus issue that has sort of roiled the waters over there, both the difference that it could make potentially on the battlefield and some of the political considerations inside of Germany that have precluded its being supplied to Ukraine thus far.
Yeah, probably I'll start with the latter, Tim, because that segues actually into the first question, which from my point of view is way more relevant. I think it's interesting. I've spoken to a few people about the Taurus aspect. So this is one weapon out of many that certainly has its particular effects, but it's not, from my point of view, the game changer to this conflict. I think no one has ever said that, but the public debate seems to focus a bit around that. If you look at that from the broader perspective, that's interesting because it seems as if Germany, as the EU's largest country, is centered around these particular missiles, whereas Germany has actually ramped up the supplies to Ukraine massively and is now, together with the US, really the major supplier of arms and weapons. And that tends to be forgotten a bit. And I think the German government has been trying to find a way to stop this debate and focus more on what they are already doing and for which actually the Ukrainian government praises them. But of course, the leaks around the potential use cases of Taurus that we've seen, which just show also the other levels of threat from cybersecurity issues that we're facing, were taking over that debate. Now, if we put it into perspective and say Taurus is not the decisive factor, but ammunition and constant supply of ammunition, constant supply of drones and air defense for Ukraine are more important. I think one interesting aspect here is how do we ensure that there is a European consensus on continuing this regardless of what US Congress does? And I think for the moment, there seems to be, we never know how stable such consensus is, but for the moment, I think there still is enough consensus that the European partners continue their supply and their support of Ukraine, because there is, of course, the wish to be prepared for potential changes in the US administration. And everyone just wants to be prepared for a situation in which Europe might need to shoulder even more of the burden so that no one comes unprepared.
Can I pull on that thread a little bit? What's the thinking? You know, an obviously diverse, you know, continent with many different political constituencies, but sort of in the security community, if you will, you know, what are the concerns and fears about what the election here will bring and what that means for Europe?
Yeah, I think it's almost impossible to kind of have a unified answer to this. As you mentioned, Tim, this is a heterogeneous continent with many, many different political camps these days. It seems like more than ever, we have European elections coming up this year where the more extremist parties are expected to have a larger say, and they will largely draw on particular views on issues like the war in Ukraine. So it is indeed interesting how the security community prepares for a potential change in the administration. I would say first, I think this is not taken for granted or anything. This is something that people say no one really knows. And we just want to make sure that we are prepared for all scenarios. Because I think everyone understands that regardless of the outcome of the US elections, there will be an ask from the US on Europe to do more for its own security. And that's regardless of who sits in the White House. So there is this planning phase right now where, for instance, the formats in which the allied parties within NATO agree on certain supplies to Ukraine do this. You know, the so-called Rammstein format, which is named after the US base here in Germany, where people meet regularly, discuss Ukrainian requests for supplies and what can be done. These are things where NATO might play a bigger role so that, you know, there's no dependency just on one partner in the alliance, but it's more becoming really an alliance endeavor. I would generally expect also with NATO's expansion that the alliance can play a role without being an active party in the conflict to just organize its members in view of these supplies and to also, you know, keep up the format for discussing things regardless of how politics in one or several of its members play out. Because as you know, NATO is also not a kindergarten. There is not always happy sunshine and there are diverging views, but still it's there. I mean, just has its birthday and people seem to see in Europe more value in being a NATO member than they probably saw 5 years ago.
That's right. I think we're recording this on April 4th, and I think it's NATO's 75th birthday today. Yep.
Happy birthday, NATO.
Happy birthday. Very timely. I want to pull a little another thread that you've kind of already talked about, Folk, is that these are all national entities that make up the EU and also the member states in NATO. But we've also talked about potentially the impact of the U.S. election. If the European community is potentially going down the road of trying to build up their own defense industry that's not as reliant, say, on the U.S., the first things that would, you know, come to mind would be, well, here's the challenges the U.S. and NATO have faced in certain areas like supply chain or one of my favorites, small and medium-sized businesses getting into the defense market. It's not just the big guys. I expect you have similar challenges over on the continent, but I wanted to ask that, is it the same sort of things that we see in the U.S. defense industrial base that will be there, plus what are the other additional challenges, right? We know, how do I get into the defense market if I'm a new company or if I have a cool new technology? For example, drones in Ukraine, largely commercial technology. We're having challenges in the U.S. having essentially commercial drones, the small stuff, not the big ones, the Reapers and everybody we had back in the day when I worked in Army acquisition. But the Department of Defense, there's a statutory ban on using drones with critical components manufactured in China. It's just something Congress put in. So we're helping tons of drone companies here in the U.S. try to navigate, how do we sell to the Department of Defense? So taking the drone example and putting that in Europe, you know, small or medium-sized businesses getting into the market, what are their barriers? And then I guess also sort of a general supply chain question, what are the barriers here that need to be, you know, dealt with or broken down so that the EU defense industrial base strategy can be successful?
That's an excellent question, Mike. And I think it is a great opportunity to remind the audience, as far as you're not in the EU, that there is still one overarching systemic difference here. These are still different member states that have aligned on a common goal. And this common goal is to have a market in which you can, in principle, I say this kind of in square brackets, sell freely from one country to another, right? And there shouldn't be any import duties or taxes or anything on these things, so that we just create a much bigger market of more than 350 million people. This has been super successful and has been really, from my point of view, the source of the European developments in the last decades after World War II. There was always some exemption for military items, because this falls, of course, into the core of policy areas that member states said, we probably want to have our last say whether these items come in here. So it doesn't even have to be the Chinese component, which certainly would also be viewed critical here. But it could also be that you say, for political reasons, we really want to have components from our own country because we want to foster our own industrial defense base here. Depending on the country you look into, it is quite different. You have referred to small, medium-sized enterprises. I find this very interesting because from my own home jurisdiction, Germany, it is an industrial power that is largely built on small and medium-sized enterprises. In particular, in the defense field, it's, you know, the big names for sure, but you will never know the hundreds of very small, partially family-owned businesses in the defense supply chain. Very often, it's actually a dual focus on defense, but also automotive or other industrial components. But certainly, they do have their expertise in defense. And for them, the route to selling to, for this example, the German MOD is largely through large system houses. And the government would impose on the system houses a requirement to involve smaller players in the supply chain. It almost happens automatically because, for one, these smaller companies are often very, very specialized and have products on which the bigger system houses rely. But secondly, you can also, under government procurement rules, oblige to float down certain parts of the contract. Now, the difficulty, and that goes back to your initial question, this works out in a national context. It's way more difficult for a small or medium-sized enterprise to do the same with a system provider in another member state. So for a German family-owned business to go to the other jurisdictions which have their own large defense industry, so these are, you know, mainly Sweden, Italy, France, Spain, and the UK, that is way more difficult. And when we started this podcast, we were talking about the political goal of having more common EU rules. And this is exactly what they want to achieve now, that there is an understanding that everyone benefits from not replicating things from scratch, which others already have. And there's nothing bad to have some Dutch components in a German product that may then be sold to a French system house, because then we don't have to do everything three times, but rather can focus the resources on what really matters.
And now you have the addition of Finland and Sweden, just to sort of wrap up and include a little discussion here on NATO expansion, that bring not only a lot of capability to the fight, so to speak, but also a lot of industrial capacity on their own as well, especially in automotive, I guess, in Sweden, and then kind of microelectronics in Finland, right?
That's absolutely right, Tim. And I think in particular, Sweden's accession has two dimensions. With having Sweden and Finland, the Baltic is now viewed basically as a NATO sea, and it limits, of course, to a certain extent, the ability for the Russian Baltic fleet. But it also has an industrial element, and that is, don't forget that Sweden was a neutral power before. There were always strong ties, of course, but it was a neutral power, and as such, it always kept its own defense industry. And so the Swedish defense industry is very well developed and can bring a lot to NATO's industrial base, because it just adds another member now that has its own ways of doing things, works very heavily on R&D, was always willing to invest into defense spending. So that is certainly interesting. The one aspect that I just find interesting in this context is, you know, that the Swedish accession took obviously longer for political reasons because there was resistance from Turkey and from Hungary in particular. And that goes back to what we discussed before. NATO is not a family in which everyone loves each other all the time, right? It's an alliance of joint interests. If you find common interest, then the parties can do things together, but otherwise they can also hold each other up. So everything should be taken with care here, but overall, I think it is certainly a strengthening of the alliance that will be welcomed.
So Falk, we can just quickly, before we let you go here, turn to the Pacific and specifically China. You know, obviously the U.S. now is sort of engaged in what is sort of emerging as kind of a quasi-Cold War, and certainly a period of intense competition, I think, is the way that the administration would put it. How is this being viewed over from your perch in Germany and more broadly in Europe? And Do you think that there is the same appetite for the kind of broad economic bifurcation, if you will, you know, sort of take, you know, pick your term, decoupling, de-risking, whatever, in Europe as there is in the US?
I think on decoupling and de-risking, probably yes. And I'll talk about it in a minute, but I do think Europe would come from a different perspective. And that has many reasons. If you look at it from the perspective of the US are engaged in the Pacific theater, so you directly have that situation where you might face off conflicts with China, which is less imminent for the general public in Europe. It is also somewhat overtaken by events in the sense that probably 3-4 years ago, everyone was looking closely at the tensions and how they increased between the US and China, and people in Europe were wondering, what does it mean for us? Now we have a conflict directly within Europe in Ukraine and then the vicinity in the Middle East, and both just make it very clear to Europeans how vulnerable security is. And I think therefore it's logical that people focus less on China and more on conflicts that are in the vicinity here. That doesn't mean that those in the national security bubble wouldn't also think a lot about the challenges that China pose, but I think they are probably looked at A, more from a geopolitical perspective, so from a potential conflict between the US and China and what that might mean for Europe and for our supply chains. But secondly, in particular from an economic perspective, and there wearing my German hat, so to say, of course, the relationships between China and the European Union and some of its member states are intense, and you just can't cut them off. And I think no one wants to do that. So this decoupling is something which we are also seeing. And someone, I think, put it in a way that Europe has stopped to be entirely naive about these things. So people see that investment from China goes into critical infrastructure, critical technologies, and this could fire back. And I mean, as I mentioned when I introduced myself, I'm doing a lot of foreign investment control procedures. Certainly, that has become a real challenge for Chinese investors, not only in Germany, but in many other member states. So it is very much a economic reality check that we're going through here. But then again, linking it to something we discussed before, there is a huge amount of capital demand for addressing all the challenges we discussed about, not only the military ones, but also the general transition of the economies. And this will not all be state money. We need private equity coming from other places of the world, and a lot will come from the US, but not only. So I think it will not be a total decoupling. It will be some de-risking and being more strategic about in which industries and which companies do we let the Chinese invest, but always with a view to keeping communication channels open, having the strong interdependence between the European and the Chinese, more broadly Asian industries, not totally ruined by some, you know, short-term political considerations.
Well, this has been a fascinating tour of, you know, many of the major issues confronting both Europe and the US. Really want to thank you for spending some time with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Falk. Thank you, Tim. I'm sure we're going to have you back in on the show when we have other topics to talk about, particularly the Ukraine conflict is still ongoing. So thank you to our audience members as well, and everyone have a good rest of the day.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.